You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Adam Driver on the cover. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Now for something from the Vanity Fair agenda. Event: Genesis, Small Car, Big Apple. At the intersection of art, music, design, sustainability, urban life, and global community, the new Genesis Mint concept premiered in a spellbinding multimedia experience on April 16th in Hudson Yards, the soaring, architecture-driven neighborhood that's become an instant destination. Introduced by Manfred Fitzgerald, global head of the Genesis brand, the thrilling event titled Small Car, Big Apple featured a fashion show by internationally acclaimed designer Prabhaga Rung, singing from Vi Higginson's Sing Harlem Choir, new choreography from Andrew Winghart, a remixed version of Fox's hit song Rise Up by music director Venus Brown, and musical artists from a range of genres, and sculptures by Michael Keller. But the star of the evening was the Genesis Mint concept, a surprisingly pared-down, all-electric luxury car created for a sustainable, cosmopolitan lifestyle.
Thank you.
Behind the Issue, Where the Light Hits the Sand, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, director and co-writer J.J. Abrams and crew weather the Jordanian sun to capture the action on planet Pisana. This article is by Mary Alice Miller. A long time ago, the 90s, in a galaxy far, far away, on set in Tozeur, Tunisia, a special relationship between Vanity Fair and Star Wars was sparked. Back then, Annie Leibovitz was one of the only outsiders that Star Wars creator George Lucas allowed on his set. Today, in the franchise's ever-evolving landscape, which includes a sale to Disney in 2012, a succession of groundbreaking directors and new characters, plus mind-bending advancements in special effects, there remains a constant. Leibovitz is still one of the few outsiders allowed. Such was the case for the new film, The Rise of Skywalker, the final installment in a trilogy of trilogies, which, according to Alan Horn, co-chairman of the Walt Disney Studios, is over 40 years in the making. President of Lucasfilm Kathleen Kennedy, director J.J. Abrams, and the team are working passionately to honor what George Lucas created, and these characters people love so much, by bringing this epic 9-film Skywalker saga to an exciting, fitting, and satisfying close. Whether on location in Ireland for 2017's The Last Jedi or in Jordan for The Rise of Skywalker, Leibovitz's behind-the-scenes portraiture has continuously provided fans with their first look at the expanding Star Wars universe. That fan base includes Lev Grossman, the creator of the Magicians novels and the eponymous sci-fi series, and the writer of this month's cover story. He was 8 when the first film came out in 1977, and he went back to the theater 6 times. It felt real in a way that you didn't feel like science fiction could be. I was chasing that feeling every time I went back, he says. I am trying not to say that I've been preparing my whole life for this story, but I have. Next photos, Abrams surveys Jordan's Wadi Rum desert, and camera operator Colin Anderson readies a take. Grossman spent time with Abrams in Santa Monica and attended the Star Wars Celebration Convention in Chicago. It's clear that, like me, J.J. was a fan first. We were both wrestling with this incredible phenomenon that is Star Wars. Grossman's extensive interviews with the cast included Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, and Anthony Daniels, who has played C-3PO from the very beginning, as well as Adam Driver, whom Grossman spoke with backstage among clanking radiators at New York's Hudson Theater, where Driver is currently starring in Burn This. My kids, who are massive Star Wars fans, says Grossman, don't understand that not everyone's dad meets the Star Wars people. As for what the 8-year-old version of the author would say if he could see himself now, Grossman thinks he'd say, "What happened to my hair?" And then, "Well, if I can't grow up to be Luke Skywalker, this is almost as good." Now for some of the contributors to this month's issue. Lev Grossman, Tour de Force. After a long career at Time, where he interviewed such luminaries as Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, Grossman published The Magicians at age 40. I was an extremely late bloomer as a fiction writer, he says, but he's loved sci-fi all his life. Star Wars is a subject about which I am slightly obsessed. Samita Mukhopadhyay, Mindy Kaling in full bloom. I have been obsessed with Mindy Kaling since The Mindy Project, says Mukhopadhyay, whose interview with Kaling left her feeling inspired. It was remarkable to see how much she'd grown and how much she's doing for other South Asian writers and actors. Mukhopadhyay is the executive editor of Teen Vogue. Mark Williams and Sarah Hirakawa, Mindy Kaling in full bloom. During their photo shoot with Mindy Kaling, Williams and Hirakawa wanted her to be radiant and free in the open field amidst the blooming flowers. It was a funny but intimate moment, rolling around in the flowers together. The duo were introduced to Kaling's work by their young son Eli, who was a huge fan of The Office. Marjan Carlos, Vanities. In her essay on bronzer, the former senior fashion writer at Vogue proves that some cosmetics go further than skin deep. When women of color, myself included, see Rihanna embrace her sun-kissed and darkened complexion, they in turn do the same, says Carlos. It helps to fight stigmas related to colorism and includes us in a conversation that has historically excluded us. William D. Cohan, Pride, In the Name of Love, a Vanity Fair special correspondent and the author of Four Friends, Promising Lives Cut Short, Cohan thinks it is an incredible irony that Bill McGlashan, this wealthy private equity investor, quasi-famous for starting a socially responsible investment fund with Bono, seemed willing to cheat to get his child into a top school. Jordy Wood, Vanities. Wood's photograph of this month's Vanities opener, Catherine Newton, is emblematic of the authentic, intimate portraiture for which the Brooklyn-based photographer is known. Wood says he and Newton were excited to pay homage to the Vanities institution, and Newton came to set ready with references to many older issues. Travis Rathbone, Vanities. For this month's bronzer story, the still-life photographer used the product itself as the medium in his nod to Roy Lichtenstein's pop art. We used stencils and freehand-cut pieces of paper to create the layered base design, Rathbone says, and then one by one, we coated them in texture. Maggie Bullock, J-Who? In high school, an older boy would occasionally loan me his J. Crew roll neck sweater, says Bullock. It felt like membership to a club. Now the former deputy editor of Elle is struck by how personal the company's struggle is for its employees. You don't pour blood, sweat, and tears into a brand for decades without caring deeply that it succeeds. Sebastian Kim, The Players. Kim, who began his career assisting the legendary Richard Avedon, wanted the actors in this issue's portfolio of Broadway talents to be expressive, energetic, and colorful, jumping off the page. But he got more than he bargained for from Bryan Cranston, who gave us an all-out dance number. Now, the editor's letter for the summer 2019 issue from Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones. In the photos, Daisy Ridley and Adam Driver on Vanity Fair's two summer covers. And we have the one here that has Adam Driver on the cover, but on newsstands, you may find the one with Daisy Ridley as well. These are the droids you're looking for. In 1997, I read an article in The New Yorker by John Seabrook called Why is the Force Still With Us? It was a look back at the three original Star Wars movies, episodes 4 to 6, in advance of the coming prequel trilogy, which began with The Phantom Menace in 1999. Before reading this piece, I had not thought of the first three films as canonical work to which one would apply critical thinking the way one might a novel or a symphony. It's not that they didn't merit it. It's that I could never have held them at such a remove. They were part of the fabric of my childhood and coming of age. They gave me my first celebrity crush, 3 guesses, and my first unconscious acquaintance with the Oedipus complex. I learned the phrase diplomatic mission. I assumed all princesses were sharp-witted, sassy, and tech-savvy enough to embed a hologram missive into a robot. This December, we'll see the end of the 9-part saga dreamed up by George Lucas back when the Second World War was only 3 decades old. In a way, as Lev Grossman writes in his feature about the final film, The Rise of Skywalker, this is timely. The threat of fascism, if not literal stormtroopers, has come back around. Not to mention all that stuff in Phantom Menace about the unwieldy tax code. Of course, the Star Wars films don't need to be timely. They long ago ascended into timelessness. It's hard to put into words the visceral effect of Annie Leibovitz's pictures for this issue. The clash of lightsabers, the camaraderie in the Millennium Falcon cockpit, the gleam of a golden droid in the desert. Taking it all in, you could be 10 years old again. Not that the world was better when you were 10, but it had more possibility, if only because you were just beginning your part in it. We Star Wars aficionados have always been affected by the role of entropy in the series. On the one hand, Luke Skywalker's mission was driven by hope, and the arc from sin to redemption mapped out by the first trilogy offers proof of progress. The galaxy could get better, if not the whole universe. People could get better. They could shed their baggage. On the other hand, that baggage doesn't disappear. Obi-Wan Kenobi's body vanishes, but his robe is left behind. The landscape is littered with detritus, both natural and man-made. It's in the scenery, that long-necked skeleton that snakes toward C-3PO at the crest of a dune on Tatooine, the junkyard on wheels run by the Jawas, the hulking ruin of an Imperial starship where Rey forages and the Force awakens, a brilliant homage to Shelley's Ozymandias. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. And it's in the language, in the plot. The Millennium Falcon is the fastest hunk of junk in the galaxy. One of the saga's most beloved scenes takes place in a trash compactor. Hyperdrives malfunction. Things fall apart. Someone's got to take out the trash. No amount of peace or prosperity can change that. Maybe that's why we love it. Famously, Star Wars reverses the usual chronology of science fiction. It takes place in the past, not the future, and the past has a way of poking into the present. My son is too young for Star Wars. I look forward to the day when he and I watch it together nearly as much as I looked forward to his birth, but he happened to hear me quote Han Solo's quip to Luke on the subject of Ben Kenobi. Where did you dig up that old fossil? And assumed the movie must be about dinosaurs, right up his alley. It isn't. But it kind of is. It's a story in which destruction and extinction play out against birth and evolution, where primordial paradises coexist with techno-hellscapes, where pathos comes from the melodic sigh of a blue and white droid as much as from the last exhale of a noble knight. It wouldn't surprise me if the final chapter is more a beginning than an end. It's been 42 years since Luke Skywalker gazed at those two suns setting on the horizon, but the word to watch in the new title is Rise. Here are some letters. Opening illustration is by Emily Robertson, which shows a woman in the ocean, or maybe it's a pool or lake, but a body of water, nevertheless, floating on an inner tube, wearing swimsuit, hat, sunglasses, and reading Vanity Fair. This quote from Nick Maffey from Brooklyn, New York: fantastical lives rarely survive close scrutiny. Now this from Jay Bischoff, Atlanta, Georgia, El Chapo. Don Winslow's article on El Chapo is spot on. The Chapo Trap, March. There will always be someone to provide drugs, as long as there is someone to buy them. And it is interesting whom we prosecute. The Sackler family is every bit as guilty as El Chapo, yet they will never see a jail cell. We call one man evil and the other a businessman. I enjoyed Winslow's article, and I look forward to the verdict. But in the end, when the cost per gram of cocaine, for instance, is $2 in Colombia and $70 in Atlanta, someone will continue to pursue those profits. From Asheville, North Carolina, Carrie Glover writes, Miley Cyrus. Zach Barron truly captured the spirit of Miley Cyrus in your March cover story, Miley Everlasting. Like her godmother, Dolly Parton, Miley is unapologetically authentic. It's hard to believe this old soul is only 26. Again, not unlike her godmother at that age. Nick Maffey writes from Brooklyn, New York, John Richardson. Once described as the man all New York wants to sit beside at dinner, Vanity Fair's one-time art critic, Sir John Richardson, introduced me to one of my favorite artists, Pablo Picasso. Richardson, who passed away in March at the age of 95, was a friend and confidant of Picasso's for 2 decades and wrote 3 biographies on the artist. Through Richardson, I learned about the tragic circumstances that led to the artist's Blue Period, 1901 to 1904. His agonizing months spent creating Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, 1907, and how he fought against modern warfare with his masterpiece Guernica, 1937. Fantastical lives rarely survive close scrutiny, and no one scrutinized Picasso's life more closely than John Richardson. Richardson's writ and wit will be missed. 30 years ago, Miles Davis. And here we have a photograph by Annie Leibovitz, August 1989, showing Miles Davis reclining on a bed. Vanity Fair, August 1989. At 63, he continues to tour and make records, but he moves through the world on his own terms, changing band members, record companies, lovers, styles of clothes. He is a man doomed to movement, a man relentlessly in his own present. And that was Miles Davis 30 years ago. Social, Selma Blair's Transformation by Julie Miller, March. I continue to be inspired by the courageous Selma Blair as I reread her At Vanity Fair interview from At Film Piper. Please take time to read or watch At Selma Blair's At GMA and At Vanity Fair interviews to educate yourselves on what multiple sclerosis is and why inclusion is important. From At Just Dawn. Coming soon, The Last Pirate of New York by Rich Cohen. Penguin Random House, out June 4th. And Bobby in Nazi Land by Robert Rosen. Head Press, out August 1st. Correction, on page 106 of the May issue, Mad About Barry by Evgenia Peretz, it was incorrectly stated that Jennifer Senior disagreed with Barry Weiss on Weiss's pro-Israel stance. Senior is pro-Israel, but her views are to the left of Weiss's. from the Vanity's opening act. Catherine Newton speaks with Vanity Fair's Britt Hennemuth. Opening photograph by Jordy Wood, styled by Tony Irvine. This quote from Catherine Newton, 22, whose summer screen hat trick is Pokemon, Detective Pikachu, The Society, and Big Little Lies. Jean-Marc Vallée was like, "I don't know if you can be tough." So I flipped off the camera. And she's pictured here wearing a gown by Carolina Herrera, hair products by Kevin Murphy, makeup and nail enamel by Chanel. And the gown is a rose-colored, strapless gown. This is the summer of Catherine Newton. You star on the big and small screens. First in Pokemon Detective Pikachu opposite Ryan Reynolds. My first day of elementary school, I had my Pikachu backpack, and I still have my cards. So it's crazy to be a part of something that defined a lot of your childhood. My character, Lucy Stevens, is a young reporter who's driven, fearless, and funny. And I'm very proud of this new world that we've created. A movie like Pokemon just doesn't come around that often. Do I hear a little accent? Honestly, it depends on who I've been hanging out with, because I'm from Miami. When I was 11, I moved to L.A. for a CBS sitcom called Gary Unmarried, so now I'm surrounded by the Valley Girl accent. If I'm in London too long, I'll come home sounding British. Jim Burrows produced that show, created Cheers, and directed Frasier, Friends, and Will and Grace. Tell me about auditioning for the sitcom king. He plays golf, and I play golf, and I think I got the gig because that was my in. They wrote golfing into the show. Do you still play? Of course. I was known as Catherine the Golfer in high school. My next tournament is at Pebble Beach, which I'm really excited about. That's one of my favorite courses. So you'll be back in Northern California, your Big Little Lies neck of the woods. Exactly. I love Carmel. The best golf and the best vintage shopping. I'm self-styled, so for the Pokemon press tour, I looked at the collections and just dreamt really big. I'm normally in sweatpants, so if I'm going to dress up, I go all out. Take me from Catherine the Golfer to being cast in HBO's star-stacked show. When you see a cast like that, you just think, they're not going to pick me. When I met director Jean-Marc Vallée, he was like, "I don't know if you can be tough." So I flipped off the camera. Well, that's as tough as I can be. The next thing I knew, I was at the table, read, sitting with Nicole, Reese, Shailene, Zoe, and Laura, and I was just watching them. Reese and I had lunch together afterwards, and I could just feel that she was going to lift me up. She really let me fly and flourish. Is there anything you can reveal about season two? You can expect a lot more conflict between me and my mother, Madeline, played by Reese, amongst all the chaos that's happening in our Big Little Lies world. A world which now includes Meryl Streep? Oh my God, when Reese told me that Meryl was going to be part of the cast, I just started screaming. She's amazing because she really adapts and listens, and it makes such a difference. It's the most professional set I've ever been on. Fan mail. This quote from Ryan Reynolds. Catherine reminds me of Bernadette Peters. Behind her approachable, kind exterior lurks a goddamned titan. From Reese Witherspoon. I am so proud of how she's taken charge of her own career, becoming a leader on her sets and amongst her peers. From Martin McDonagh. I can't imagine any other young actress going toe-to-toe with Frances McDormand and not being intimidated. The Hive Report, Campaign Recess. Whether you're a voter or a visitor in one of these early primary states, here's the food to eat and the sights to see, as inspired by a few Democratic front runners. And the illustration shows a map of the United States with some states highlighted, arrows drawn to the respective candidates. Get hyped in Burlington, Iowa, bean counter, coffee house, and drinkery. Long before Beto O'Rourke's Desert Boots graced its bar, Bean Counter was serving organic fair trade coffee to Burlington locals. Stop in for an iced latte with a shot of Bailey's, but please stay off the counter. Find your bliss in Las Vegas, Nevada, Springs Preserve. Just west of packed Las Vegas Boulevard, the Springs Preserve, which Elizabeth Warren visited in February, features museums, galleries, miles of trails, and a stunning botanical garden brimming with cacti. Find art in Manchester, New Hampshire, Currier Museum of Art. The crowds swarming in April came to see South Bend's electric millennial mayor, Pete Buttigieg. But the museum's collection is just as dynamic. Picasso and O'Keeffe's paintings, plus tours of Frank Lloyd Wright's Zimmerman House. Pig out in Charleston, South Carolina. Rodney Scott's Whole Hog Barbecue. Kamala Harris ordered the whole hog sandwich, greens, and cornbread with butter and honey, but it's hard to go wrong with any menu item conceived by pitmaster Rodney Scott, who's been roasting hogs since age 11.
Thank you.
Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton, a Vanity Fair podcast. Will Donald Trump get impeached? Should Washington break up Facebook? Can Netflix win the streaming wars? Nick Bilton brings you inside the room where decisions are made through in-depth, revealing conversations with the biggest newsmakers in Silicon Valley, on Wall Street, and in Washington. Inside the Hive by Vanity Fair. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.